even though I was born in the 1980s, I really am a child of the 90s. It's for this reason that John Hughes means almost nothing to me. I know, but Gen Xers need to understand that for me, he was just some dude that made high school movies. It's because of this ignorance that some 90s movies that were clearly Brat Pack influenced felt fiercely original to me, since I had little to no knowledge of the movies they were wholesale ripping off. One such teenage comedy came out right in the prime of my high school years, and it snuck up on me as one of those, "this is way better than it has any business being" type films. I found it incredibly relatable, and it wasn't until years later that I made any connection to John Hughes as an obvious influence. I don't really care about 16 Candles or The Breakfast Club, but I was a really huge fan of its 90s counterpart. Can't hardly wait.
Welcome to The Hold Up. Each month, we pick a movie one of us remembers fondly but hasn't seen in years, watch it, and decide, does it hold up? I'm John Nelson.
And I'm John Longinot.
Happy summer, everybody. Summertime, the living's easy.
Ooh, hot town, summer in the city. One week it's hot as shit, and the next week it's kind of cold, and the next week it's hot again, and, you know, we destroyed the earth, yeah.
L.A. remembered it was a coastal town all of a sudden, and it's been hot and cold. Greetings, John. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. How's your summer been?
Oh, it's just kicking off, but, you know, it's going okay, I think.
Well, it's about time then when we did a high school graduation film, yes?
Yes, absolutely. We just missed graduation.
I know. We should have done this a month earlier, but...
We went to summer school, and now we finally got that diploma.
But tonight's film we are going to be dealing with is Can't Hardly Wait, the 90s Jennifer Love Hewitt, Seth Green... classic? We'll find out.
I gotta say, I can't hardly wait to watch this movie tonight.
I hate your guts. But before we get started, if you have anything you want to tell us, any knowledge you want to drop on us, you can find us at holduppodcast.com, or you can drop us an email at holduppodcast@gmail.com, as our old friend Jeremy Bear did, with this email, subject, Cannonball Run. Which listeners may remember was the one we did last time.
Fine film.
Oh, man. Was that something? It even prompted me at the end to apologize for subjecting everyone to it. So Jeremy writes in to say, "Don't you mugs ever apologize for watching a bad movie. Think of it as throwing yourself on a live grenade tossed into a foxhole. Your brothers in arms thank you for your sacrifice. JB." Well, thank you, Jeremy. That's much more noble.
I don't see a purple heart in this email, you know, our medal that we get for enduring that battle.
Well, maybe some things are just sort of understood.
It's like a
posthumous award. They're just waiting for us to die so they can put our name up on a gravestone or something. So if you have anything to add to that discussion, folks, Cannonball Run, The Shadow, any of our recent hits, go ahead and drop us a line at holduppodcast.com. But tonight, John Longinot, we are redeeming ourselves, one hopes, with Can't Hardly Wait.
Yes, that is the plan. I can't hardly wait to watch a good movie for once. Oh, hopefully, we'll see.
I hope you do that the whole hour, boy. That's...
Well, you can't hardly wait for me to stop, so...
But first things first.
Everyone just tunes out.
Exactly. That was the four people who were still listening. They're gone. So now we can talk amongst ourselves, John. Tell me, Mr. Longinot, you said that you saw this in high school.
That's correct.
What were the circumstances surrounding your first viewing?
So I want to say that I did not catch it in the theater, but it was around my junior or senior year of high school. And I definitely caught it on video, probably while I was working at the video store, and watched it that way. And I remember amongst my friends in high school, this kind of became a movie we really enjoyed. Mainly because, you know, I mean, it's kind of cliche, but like, hey, we were in high school and the movie's taking place in high school and we were graduating soon and they're graduating the movie. There's all these things just lined up to be kind of appropriate for that time in my life.
Right.
I mean, that was about as far as the accuracies went. I don't recall, you know, getting lucky with the, like, hottest girl in the school or, like, having the jock, you know, like,
get his, or, you know, there's a lot of things about the movie that I think are fairly unrealistic, certainly to my high school life.
Right.
But in terms of they were graduating, that lined up. So,
okay, well, perfect.
Yeah. But I remember just really enjoying it. I rented it on a lark, didn't think it was going to be that great, but I was like, oh, Seth Green's in it. Maybe this will be funny. I generally don't kind of like romantic comedies or whatever, and not that this was kind of a high school comedy,
right?
But there was definitely sort of a romance angle to it.
Yeah,
so I was sort of doubtful about that. But then when I watched it, I really remember, and I don't remember a lot of specifics, I just remember it being very funny,
right,
and enjoyable, more so than I would have expected.
Yeah, I saw it later than video. It came out on video, and then like a couple years later my wife convinced me to watch it, and I was dragged kind of kicking and screaming into watching it, and by the end of it I was like, that was okay. So I may have been unduly influenced with, you know, watching it all grumpy with the puss face and right, just be ready to hate it, and then it sort of won me over, sort of, you know, and went from hate to like stalemate, I guess. Hate to stalemate. I like that. It went from hate to stalemate. But I remember actually, like you say, liking it more than I had any reason to, or, you know, it was better than it had any reason to be.
Yeah.
Especially given what they were obviously pushing it as. You know, I remember, you know, it was completely sold as like, hey, look, here's a fun teenage romp and everybody is silly and stupid and making the jokes that you've seen in every other trailer, so why should this be any different? So I was actually surprised that there was a little bit more depth to it. But yeah, I watched the movie and I don't remember almost anything about it except that Seth Green played a white hip-hop dude, you know, talking, what up,
yes,
y'all,
yes,
and talking in
Seth Green was very memorable. I remember that.
Yeah, and he was very funny. Yeah. But I like Seth Green anyway. He had already been in, I think, Buffy that point, right?
For
yeah,
sure.
So I was already a fan of him, so that him and, you know, the promise of watching Jennifer Love Hewitt was, you know, always fine. I mean,
sure, it didn't hurt.
Yeah,
know?
Exactly. That, well, sure. You know, I wasn't expecting too much acting wise, but I was like, meh, pretty girls can always make something better, right?
So, which one of us do you think should kind of like? Because I don't remember the movie. I remember some, maybe more than you, I'm not sure, but we should probably let people know like what the movie's about.
Well, why don't you do that? Because I vaguely remember it's like, you know, the night of graduation and like you say, people hook up with people and
sure,
but I don't know anything else. So you go ahead.
Okay, great. So from my memory, Can't Hardly Wait is a pretty tried and true standard, almost outright cliche kind of high school movie. The idea is it's taking place on graduation day. And so I think the kids, it's a senior class of a high school and they're graduating and then they're going to this after graduation party.
Right. Where all of everybody's dreams will come true.
Everybody's there. And then in a very movie like serendipitous way, everything sort of aligns to where these people's completely change who they are overnight and have these revelations about themselves. So I want to say Ethan Embry is the lead.
Okay.
Whom you might remember from stuff like Empire Records or Vegas Vacation and just kind of these random movies.
All right.
This is like one of the few times he was like a lead of a movie.
Okay.
And you'll definitely recognize him when you see him. And so it's Ethan Embry and Jennifer Love Hewitt are sort of our mains. And Jennifer Love Hewitt, of course, as is required by law in 90s cinema, or maybe all of cinema about high school, is like the popular girl at the school whom everyone has a huge crush on,
right,
including our hero, Ethan Embry, who's kind of like a nerdy guy. He's certainly not popular, but he's always loved this girl.
Right.
And I think she's there's a high school jock whom she has like just broken up with. Or as the movie goes on, we'll very soon break up.
During the course of this 24 hours, this amazing 24
exactly,
hours.
So I want to say that the kind of MacGuffin of the movie is like, oh man, this girl who's been locked down for all of high school and everyone's obsessed with is like on the market tonight, you know, which sounds awful. But like, I think that's the idea is
right,
like, oh man, she's available. And everyone's like just losing their shit, like
right,
trying to get with her, I think.
Right.
And Ethan Embry always had this dream to be with her. That's sort of like the main story. And then the kind of B side, there's like lots of B stories,
right?
And the other kind of most prominent one that I remember is Seth Green is a hip hop gangsta kid driving around in a Humvee and has like ridiculous like MC Hammer pants and I think like Power Man 5000 goggles or something, just like
that
insane.
Sounds right.
He basically like just looks like Power Man 5000. And then he has a plot with Ethan Embry's friend, who's this woman whose name I don't recall, but she was sort of a character actress. She's got red hair, I remember, right. Like short red hair. And she's definitely been in some stuff that is just not coming to my mind at the moment. It's sort of like she's Ethan Embry's friend, and then she used to be friends with Seth Green, I want to say, in like junior high or something. And that they get locked in a bathroom together. I remember that.
Okay, yeah.
So their movie is like, he's ridiculous and she's very progressive and down to earth. And they sort of like are trapped in a bathroom together, having to, you know, overcome their issues or right. something. And I think it gets romantic, like, you know, so there's some kind of like,
well, that's the only,
on that.
That's the only thing I remember specifically, is because whilst trapped in this bathroom, they end up hitting it. And then Seth Green decides to be a dick about it.
Right. As of course is what happens.
Right. And so I don't remember even I know he feels bad about it, but I don't remember how it all resolves itself. I'm sure it's fine.
And then, yeah, of course. That's the thing about the movie. I'm pretty, it's not a spoiler to say things kind of end well for Moe's.
Right.
There is a third plot I recall of a very nerdy kid, of course, because it's high school and there has to be a nerdy kid. Uh-huh. I don't remember this actor's name, but he is an alumni of the holdup because he's the son of Robin Williams from Hook.
Oh, okay.
And you may also recall him from Dick Tracy. He's like the kid in Dick Tracy.
Okay.
He's in this movie a little older, and I want to say it's one of the last movies he was in. I don't think his career really spanned beyond this that I'm aware of. But he's this nerdy high school kid who goes to the party, probably. I'm sure his friends are like, we shouldn't be here or whatever. And I remember him like getting drunk and singing a bunch of Guns N' Roses.
Oh, okay.
He's singing like Guns N' Roses, Sweet yes. Child of Mine or
right.
something. I don't
know. Okay.
Or it might have been, Welcome to the Jungle or something.
Sure.
I don't remember. But he somehow becomes like super popular overnight. That's kind of what happened. Like, that's what I remember. Everyone's in these very stereotypical high school roles. And then in one evening, they completely transcend like butterflies and come out of their cocoons and are like, I think it's one of those, childhood to adulthood.
Right.
Pretty typical stories.
Sure. All right. Well, now that we've gotten that out of the way, Longino, them fighting words you were bringing up about John Hughes. Let's discuss that.
What are you talking about? I didn't say anything incendiary about John Hughes.
How dare you, sir? How dare you besmirch the name of the god of teen 80s cinema? How dare you?
I dare to.
Stand and deliver.
Well, I'll tell you right now, there is one exception to this burn that I laid out, and that's
sick burn.
I love Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I think that's a great movie. I've seen it many times. I haven't seen a terrible many John Hughes films, but that's probably his best one that I've seen.
How dare you?
And I have seen The Breakfast Club, but in the context of like, I don't get what the big deal is.
Mm.
It's okay.
What?
That was kind of my thing.
You dirty son of a
bitch. I know it's like Voice of a Generation or whatever. And then I have never seen any of his other movies. I've never seen Weird Science. I've never seen Pretty in Pink. I've never seen, I know there's another one, 16 Candles.
Well, there's 16 Candles. There's some Kind of Wonderful.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Is his. I don't know if he directed it or
it's
just
really,
wrote it.
My only context for John Hughes is Ferris Bueller, Breakfast Club, and the plethora of films that ripped him off. Like, that's, and of which I think, to my memory, this is definitely one of them. Like, it
right.
feels like that kind of John Hughes
thing. Oh, yeah,
thing.
Most definitely. Well, for my money, here's the thing. When I was in high school, I was a John Hughes kid, and so he held that place in my heart for a long time. But longtime listeners will remember in one of our grab bag episodes, we were asked, which director do we think does not hold up anymore? And I had chosen John Hughes for that because I don't, I have seen some of his films since. I know they haven't aged well. 16 Candles, I didn't actually like when I was a kid. I didn't get it then, and I get it even less. I mean, I get why... pardon me, ladies. I get why girls liked it, but I don't really understand why it enjoyed such a huge space in everybody's heart. Because even at the time, it was like, this is kind of stupid and
okay,
oddly rapey in a lot of points. I mean, if you watch it now with the hashtag Me Too and whatnot, I mean, you look at it and your eyes will bug out of your head.
Okay.
Back then, it was sort of like, yeah. taking girls' panties and, you know, them sleeping in the cars while they're drunk and we're driving them around. And, you know, that's all in good fun,
Jeez,
right?
Another 80s movie where a drunk woman's being driven around the back of a car.
Oh, hell like, yeah. No, not the back. This one got to stay in the front.
Okay. But, not in the trunk.
But she was drunk, so she liked to kiss people that she didn't know.
For hardcore listeners will know I'm referring to License to Drive, where Heather Graham was unconscious in the back of a vehicle in the rapey, horrible 80s.
Speaking of John Hughes and the rapey, horrible 80s, yeah. I love Breakfast Club. It was actually my first John Hughes film. I haven't actually watched that in many years, and I wonder what a grown-up man like myself would think of that, but...
Well, it says a lot that I kind of sympathize with the principal the first time I saw it.
Well, then you're
just... I was like, these kids need some straightening out. They're all kind of dicks.
Well,
like,
then you are out of your goddamn mind. But I could say, I feel like that movie is sort of his more, like, thinky movie, and sure. The rest of them are a little more kinetic. But yeah, and Ferris Bueller is great because it's just, you know, anarchy, but like,
yeah, well,
I don't know.
That's way more my speed. Like, Ferris Bueller is like a pure comedy, almost like farcical film.
Right.
Like, it's so surreal and just bananas. I like that movie a lot.
The Hughesian leaps of logic in other movies don't sort of stand out. Like, again, there's stuff in like 16 Candles that I'm like, ooh, that I don't understand why this is in this movie. Whereas like Ferris Bueller, it's sort of a perfect mesh of like a Looney Tunes cartoon and a teenage movie, so that worked out fine. And Some Kind of Wonderful, like I mentioned, that was actually one of my I really liked that one too, but I have only seen it once or twice, and I because I had never seen Eric Stoltz in a leading role before that, so that was my introduction to a leading man, Eric Stoltz. Yeah, and it was just, I don't know, there's stuff in that doesn't make a whole lot of sense either, but it worked at the time for me. But there you go, there's our John Hughes bibliography.
Well, I mean, the reason I bring him up in the intro is it's something that, like, literally when I first saw Can't Hardly Wait, I'd seen Ferris Bueller, and I think that's it. Like, and honestly, that one to me seems like the outlier of his movies in terms of the style and the mood.
Yeah.
And so I really mean it that I saw Can't Hardly Wait, and it was all new to me. I was like, oh wow, you know. I mean, obviously, A High School Story isn't fiercely original, but it's that whole thing of like, this was kind of my first, hey, you're a kid and you're becoming an adult, and let's sit down, let's take a knee and talk about it. You know, that tale's been told so many times, but it was kind of my first one, and so in a way it's always held this like special place for me. And, you know, this was kind of came out really close to something like, let's say, American Pie.
Right.
It was kind of in the same zone. Like, right. But that movie, you know, to me, this always struck me as really emotional. And I was like, I'm not going to lie. Like, I was a shitty kind of angsty high school kid that was like, emotions are for idiots. And I like movies about the Predator and, you know, and horror films. And, you know, it's in a way, it was like it melted my ice cold heart to watch Can't Hardly Wait. And by the end of the movie, I was like, go, Ethan Embry, you got it, buddy. You know, like that kind of thing. So, I don't know what, it's just like I have a fond memory of it. I've always really liked it, but I'm very, very curious to watch it again because that's one of those right time, right place. I'm like right exactly where I need to be to enjoy this movie to the core.
Right.
And now, like, I mean, it's not going to hit me like that, you know,
right.
And I'm much more, you know, well versed in movies, and I can make an argument like, wow, this is like just a John Hughes ripoff, probably.
Right.
And so I'd like to see it in that vein and see if it's still good.
Sure. Or it might be like, you know, in the vein of like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which, you know, even John Hughes was ripping that one off. So maybe maybe it's a direct descendant of that.
That's another one that I was just like, I don't get it. Like, I watched it, I was like, this is fine. I mean, freaks out about the topless, you know, Phoebe Cates or whatever, but like,
yeah,
everybody, fine, but
everybody knows you hate Cameron Crowe. You and your Cameron Crowe.
Oh,
John,
that was a
Hughes
Cameron Crowe movie?
He wrote it. He didn't direct it, I think.
Okay, no wonder it's half bad. That makes sense now.
You're awful. That's why nobody likes you.
There are people out there that like me. There's a few.
Well, here's the
hi, people don't like me. All two of you.
Whatever. Write in and prove it, folks.
Yes. Please support my hatred of bad movies that people like.
Well, the trick with John Hughes movies, or at least the trick it seemed to me at the time, was like you know, teenagers speaking, of course, in like these amazing like soliloquies and quips and things like that, that they had, you know, no business actually being able to come up with off the top of their heads. That was sort of A, you know, it was pre-Tarantino like movie soliloquies. It was also, I mean, it's not like this is the first set of movies that had ever done this, but Hughes was really good at like grown-ups are like other. They are completely right. Like not even necessarily the bad guy, but they are just like completely, they don't understand you and you don't understand them. And he drew a real line in the sand about like, well, grown-ups have passed the point that they understand
right.
What the teenage situation is.
I want to say we discussed that idea a lot in Pump Up the Volume.
Yes.
Like we might even mention John Hughes
sure.
Watching that, which makes sense because that is definitely in the same vein.
Yeah. Well, even the Breakfast Club, one of the kids says it outright. It's like when you get old, your heart dies. So that was...
Is that what he says in that movie?
No, Ali Sheedy says that. When you get old, your heart dies.
Okay. I'm like rolling my eyes at that line.
He's rolling his eyes, but I'm like, tell her she's wrong. Go ahead and try. Look your daughter in the eye and tell her she's wrong. Tell her your heart's still alive.
I feel like my heart was dead until I saw Can't Hardly Wait, and then it awoken.
So what else do you remember anything? You don't remember anything specific?
I remember in a weird like crossover universe, there's a character who was, I think I first saw this actor in, what's that? Oh, God. There's like an indie film, Angus. There's this redheaded kid that I first saw in Angus that like somehow ended up in every high school movie made in the 90s because he's probably best known in American Pie as the Shermanator.
I don't know
if you remember this character,
yep.
You know, who's uh-huh. Nerdy redheaded kid who's just a kind of nerdy character actor. I believe he's also in this movie.
Okay.
But he's not like the Shermanator. He's another guy that might as well be the same character. Like almost identical.
Right.
And so I always had this fun game in my head where I'm like, is this the same? Like, did he transfer schools or like what's going on here?
He's like Randall Flagg. He moves between worlds. He's the same guy.
Exactly.
He just pops up in every high school in America to be the Shermanator or some version of the Shermanator to teach, you know, to be the springboard,
there
the MacGuffin for kids to learn new lessons.
And the only other thing I remember is there is an interesting scene where, so the high school jock guy, and actually I think this guy's in Twilight as like the vampire dad of the vampire family. Yeah.
Well, that's how things happen is the teenagers of your youth become the parents of the next one.
I know. Now he's the parents of the high school people, but I forgot that guy's name, but he's like he's the one that Jennifer Love Hewitt and him have broken up. And I remember he has a scene where he's like kind of at his low, and then he's at the party, and then there's a kind of like this Matthew McConaughey Dazed and Confused role. It's Jerry O'Connell's in the movie.
Okay.
As a former jock who graduated like 1 or 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And then he has a scene with the current jock guy. And I want to say there's some kind of transfer of like, it's the jock guy kind of realizes that the path he's going on is going nowhere. Like Jerry O'Connell's like kind of a douche.
Right.
And he has this sort of moment of clarity where he's like, oh my God, this is where I'm heading. Like I could be this guy. And
right.
He thought he was so cool when he was in high school, but now he's like hanging around and is kind of a loser. That's what I remember. I think that's it.
Okay.
Those are the big ones. Oh, and I do remember the ending, which I won't give away. Maybe we'll talk about when we come back.
All right. Sounds good.
But it's a little sappy. I'll say that.
What? Huh? How dare you? All right, well, then I guess it's time to place a bet on this. What do you think, John? Do you think the movie Can't Hardly Wait will, in your esteem, hold up?
I think that it will. And my main reason is the first time I saw it, my expectations were fairly low. Like, I kind of, on a lark, just threw it on.
Right.
Not really expecting much. And my biggest memory of the movie, more so than any of the plot we've discussed, was just the idea that it was so much better than I had expected.
That
was my big takeaway. Like, wow, this is like incredibly watchable and really good for the dumb movie that it is.
Right.
And I'm really hoping that quality remains. So I think if that's still there, then it's going to hold up just fine. If it's not there, we'll see. But I think it will be there and I think it will hold up.
See, I'm in a weird zone with this one because I had the same problem coming into it the first time, which is like, well, this movie's going to suck and there's no way it can be any good. And then I came out of it, you know, hate to stalemate. And so I kind of, you know, I was like, oh, I get it. Okay, that was pretty good. I give this a pass. So I wonder, am I going to watch it tonight being like, oh, I remember this being good, and be like, this is not as good as I remember it being, which it, you know, it, hopefully it's not. But I'm going to, I think I'm going to play it safe tonight and say, well, it's not going to be as good as the first time I saw it when I was really shocked that it could be. See, now that it's like, it already pulled the trick out of the bag of like, see, I'm actually a good movie. I'm going to be like going in like, oh, it's going to be a good movie. Eh, that was all right. That's my guess. I'm going to say it's not exactly like doesn't hold up, but I'm guessing it won't be as good as that first time I came out of it.
Hold on. You have to say does hold up or doesn't hold up.
I'm going to say doesn't hold up, but okay. I'm you know, caveating that with the fact that it's like, it's not a bad movie. It's just not going to be as good as that first time.
Just making sure.
This whole thing lately about it's like, no, it's got to be as good or better as that first time, that first virgin time that you saw it. So now the die is cast. We have a split vote as we go into this. So, folks, we are going to go watch this here movie, and we will come back and render verdict on Can't Hardly Wait.
And I can't
stop.
Hardly.
No.
Wait.
You're fired.
To see it.
You're fired.
I can't hardly wait.
I told you you're fired. Get out.
At first, it was also unbelievable. Mike Dexter wanted to date me. I know why I started dating him. I just don't know why I did it for so long.
Well, he is the most dope guy in school.
Yeah, and school's over.
This party tonight? Amanda suddenly being single? It's fate. Fate has opened me a window.
Yo, I gots to have sex tonight. It took me all day, but I narrowed it down to a list of 10 very lucky finalists. You know what I'm saying?
Do you think there'll be any girls there?
Are you kidding me? People may even be having sex tonight. Oh.
Can I pass away?
Hike an hillside! Kiss my ass!
Have you seen Amanda Beckett?
Yeah, Matt just saw her in there.
I'm thinking about asking her out, boy.
Oh, God, you're a hottie.
Can I pass away?
I filled this with 7 bottles of vodka last September. It's been in my freezer for...
All right, y'all, check it. Time to get busy.
Who does he think he is? Brad Pitt?
And you're like Glennon.
But with bigger boobs.
Oh, totally bigger boobs.
I can't feel my legs. I can't feel my legs!
Columbia Pictures presents an event 18 years in the making. When you find out who your friends really are.
I don't think she's prettier than Gwyneth.
Not even.
What your future really holds.
I am going to have sex with someone at this party.
And how one night can change your life.
I don't know about you, but I really believe that there's one person out there. And for me, it's gotta be Amanda.
There's a mirror right there. Why don't you take a look, okay? You're white. How's it gonna be when
you so I'm out there? Guys like us, we are a dime a dozen. When there's no
one there to talk to. There is fate, but it only takes you so far because once you're there, it's up to you to make it happen.
Amanda?
Can't hardly wait.
Which team has the winning play? Huntington, Huntington, hey, hey, hey!
And that was the greatest summer of my life. Here we are, folks, back again from Can't Hardly Wait. And
I'm
John,
sure you couldn't hardly wait for us to return from that lovely film.
I'm going
to
ignore that. John, this is a great day already because you know why? You're awake and you stayed awake for the whole movie.
I know.
It's been a few months.
Usually a good sign.
So stay tuned, folks. All right. So initial thoughts, John?
Well, for right out the gate, I can see why High School John really liked the movie.
Oh, okay.
Because it's a fantasy film. I don't know why the movie about the long shot magical letter that makes the hottest girl in school fall in love with you upon a single reading, even though she's never interacted with you in real life in any capacity and is willing to drop her life, kiss you, and be with you for the rest of her life. I don't know why I found that appealing as a high school kid.
I love science fiction.
With no girlfriend.
That's what that is. That's pure science fiction is what that is.
Absolutely. So, yes, my initial impressions are that aspect of the movie, which obviously is like the main plot of the movie, is pretty, fantasyful. But, what's interesting is I found the far more relatable and much more appealing story of the movie was the Seth Green and I forgot her name, but you were right. She was in 6 Feet Under.
Yes. Lauren Ambrose, we're talking about.
Yes, yes. So what was interesting to me was that was the far more grounded, relatable, normal story where they were people that had a relationship in like junior high or they were like friends.
Right.
They established that they had a sleepover. They had a falling out. They get locked in this bathroom and then they sort of find their way into hooking up with each other. And even when they do, it's not this like, and we were meant to be together forever. And we're madly in love. They have their doubts. They're kind of like, to me, they played very naturally. And I mean, obviously, Seth Green is kind of an exaggerated, hip hop character or whatever.
Sure.
But he kind of becomes grounded in that bathroom. And I think of all the stories, that was the one, especially this time watching it, that I was the most like invested in any kind of realistic way.
I don't think it's any coincidence that the best two actors in the film were, portraying that story because they were in sort of one universe and everybody else was in sort of this wacky Animal House universe where just what it's weird. I mean, I was going to save this for later, but I feel like I got to get this out of the way. It does have a John Hughesian like vibe to it. And I sort of realized while I was watching it, what that Hughesian vibe was, which is like, women and men in this universe don't like women much.
Well, yeah, that's...
And I know it's
definitely problematic.
Part of the time, and I know that there were things that were funny at once upon a time that you look at it now and it's like, well, that's kind of glossing over a whole, like, half the population. Like you say,
the Bechdel test is not passed for a solid second in this film.
Absolutely not. And that's totally a John Hughes flaw as well. Is like, it's weird. It has, like, one super strong female character who is her own woman, and that is the Lauren Ambrose character. There's Jennifer Love Hewitt, who is portrayed as like the strong, upstanding female of the movie, but she's so cardboard and it's not her fault, but it is just like...
Well, in a weird, ironic twist, her whole arc in the movie is like, I have been defined as this guy's girlfriend for 4 years, and she's like lost her own identity. She like literally says to her cousin, like, I don't know if people see me as anything else. I don't know if I see me as anything else. She has this very self-aware, like, I've lost my identity.
Yeah.
And I'm just someone's girlfriend. And the solution to that is apparently to just jump into the arms of Ethan Embry and become his girlfriend and then let the titles tell us that they are still together as in this is now who she is. Like, that it is a little tone deaf of like, well, wait a minute. Like, do you sort of put this progressive platform up of like her character and then completely subvert it by having her just do the same thing again? Like, that I agree, that is a little strange.
Now the weirdest thing about this is a John Hughes movie, you sort of accept that, like, well, he was the writer and often the director, he's a male single all by himself in that job. This was directed and written by a man and a woman team.
Sure.
So you would think that the woman half of the team might like look at this and go, yeah, I know it's funny, but can we fucking have some real women characters in this, please? Because I mean, besides those two that we named, every other woman character in the film is jumping on a dude's jock for that's the joke. That's gag for most of these women, is like, how many times, how many women can one dude, attract?
Well, now to be clear, not that this defends the movie in any way, shape, or form, but if we want to be technically correct, Melissa Joan Hart did have a lover, and it was her yearbook.
That's true.
The only thing that she was concerned with.
That is 100%
true. Was getting signatures for a yearbook. So.
And, speaking of Melissa Joan Hart, I had forgotten that everybody on planet fucking Earth was in this movie.
Oh, my God. I know. It was literally just, you couldn't go 2 minutes without, like, holy shit, here's this person or that person.
I mean, they had, like, I don't know, Freddie Rodriguez, Eric Balfour, Selma Blair was in there for, like, 10 seconds.
Just a random person. Jason Segel.
Jason Segel. Siegel. Yeah, another 10-second. And then Tara from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I forget the actress's name, yeah, but she was like...
literally an extra.
Yeah, just the camera passes over her staring at a banana. And I just, if you didn't know her face, it was just like everybody in this movie became famous, whether extra or...
Jamie Presley from My Name is Earl. Yeah, she was
as girlfriend
there,
as, number one.
Yeah, literally billed as like girlfriend number one.
That was like, the other thing, to be like watching the credits and it's like girlfriend number one, girlfriend number two, girlfriend number three, girl who hits on other guy number one. I mean, it was...
Oh, shit. You know what? I just realized I'm wrong about Melissa Joan Hart, because right at the very end of the movie, they have her hold hands with the guy that's always talking about memories.
Yes.
So even they like cook her up.
Yes, but
like,
I
it's
mean,
a Bollywood film. Like everybody's got a pair off.
But that doesn't... I mean, your point is true, though. For like 95% of the movie, she had one other lover, and that was her yearbook.
And then I guess there's the girl throwing the party who's just concerned about her house. But everyone's one note. Like, whatever that note is, that is what they are the whole movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean... in fairness, most of the men come off as pretty dumb, so it's not like just the women are one note and cardboard. Sure. It's like most of the dudes are, like you say, pretty one note as well. I don't know. There was just something about it that, and I totally agree. It's very Hughesian inspired, where it's like this fantastical like universe in which just shit just falls into place for the dude at the end. You better be that dude though, because everybody else is fucked.
Yeah. I mean, is there something to the idea? Is this some sort of commentary on the shallowness of high school? Like, these people are all sort of playing their archetypes, and then a few of our characters are sort of coming out of that in a way or challenging it. I mean,
I suppose. I don't know. I mean,
there seems to be a lot in this movie about high school politics and just sort of like, you know, your class in high school, whether you're one of the, you know, socialites or a jock or a goth or a nerd. Or, I mean, it, you know, not that that's never been done before, but it seems like the huge thing in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the currency of the movie is your popularity. And there's a whole lot, you know, there's a lot of like undermining of like, oh, the jock and the geek and the, you know, the nerds and the not popular girls and the popular girls. There's a lot of like jabs at, you know, high school status quo. Like at one point Jennifer Love Hewitt like asked some random girl like, oh, do you know who this guy is? And the girl that she asked is obviously like a gothish type chick, and she's like cutting something with a pair of scissors and starts talking about like, oh, why would you notice a beautiful soul like him, you and your rich popular friends? And it, you know, and Jennifer Love Hewitt has not much to say to that because it's true. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I see that. I feel like the movie sort of like starts to turn things on its head, but
sure,
you know, I don't know. There's something about it. It gets there some of the times and not others.
Well, it's weird. It's like it rubs up against the door of challenging the status quo of high school. Like you have Jennifer Love Hewitt gives kind of a random speech about how she can't believe she dated this guy for so long, but she just really liked being the popular girl school.
Right.
And the previous, she was like, she was a student that came in, you know, mid school from a different school. And all of a sudden she was in a different class and she really was into that. You know, you have the nerdy kid and the jock kid randomly becoming best friends for a bit. And it's kind of like all's forgiven. But then the next day, you know, he's just the douche he's always was.
Yeah. Which that part I actually liked. I liked that he like in the cold, harsh light of day, he reverts, you know, it's exactly that's, I mean, that's very Breakfast Club as well. It's like the idea that like, well, we shared this friendship for a moment, but you know, the minute I get back into my comfort zone, then I'm going to shit on you again. And everything's going to revert back to what it was. So it kind of makes sense that Jennifer Love Hewitt, when the son comes up, is like, eh, I guess I better find a dude because that's what I'm used to, you know, for one night and one night only. I felt the power of being single. But
and actually the other commentary on that kind of social status that probably was the most relatable was the Seth Green stuff in the bathroom, where she was saying something along the lines of, you know, hey, we used to be friends and then you left me to go to the cool kids table and to be trendy. And sort of this admission of like, hey, we naturally are just friends, but the construct of the social structure of high school has ripped us apart and you felt the need to be in Limp Bizkit or something.
Right.
And,
well, she also does mention that he comes from money and she does not.
And she doesn't.
Though that seems, I don't know, that, I mean, just examining that now, that seems the only time that ever plays out is that second that she says it. It's like there's no other time in which his richness is a barrier to her poorness. You know, it's not that it's bad. It's just that it's like, well, why throw that in additionally to just like, well, we, you know, grew apart and that was weird enough. So why the wrong side of the tracks element as well? Again, not a necessarily a bad
because they
thing.
Had to check it off the list of, of the stories that are told.
But didn't it feel like that? I mean, didn't it feel like there needed to be a rich slash poor thing going on somewhere? I mean,
you know, West Side Story, this is not, but, but you know, I mean, it hits that a little bit, I suppose.
A little bit. But again, I mean, I forgive it in that story because at least there was levels and, you know, emotions in that story. I mean, they're fairly goofy emotions and levels, but at least, you know, those two were doing their best.
I will say I was surprised yet again watching it in that the narrative we're talking about is very archetypal, very standard, not terribly original, but within the sandbox the movie sort of constructs, it's pretty funny. Like, yes. There was more than a few jokes that I was actually just kind of laughing out loud at, and it has a good pace to it.
Right.
And an odd sort of, I don't want to call it self-aware, but like a little bit of just, I don't know, the comedy in the movie is actually pretty funny, and I think that helps it a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I think the funniest gag in the whole thing, and you were mentioning it while we were watching it, is the band like having its entire like lifespan. It's like they start to play a song, they haven't played a single note before they start breaking up, and then or they start fighting on stage, and then they fight and they break up, and then they get back together again, never play a note. But
yeah,
this
band that with the frontman is Brecken Meyer, actually, to add to the list of people. And
the drummer who likes wearing cowboy hat is the dude from Scrubs. Again, everybody in this was fucking famous, but I love seeing the band go through their very short lifespan in one night. And if this is a tried and true joke, but yet it worked for me too, is like they start to play, they start arguing. As they're arguing, someone in the audience yells, "You guys suck," which such an easy joke, but I always love it when people tell a band that they suck. I don't know why. Yeah. It's so easy. It's so
this generic. Movie actually had a ton of just random yelling out from strangers for like a punchline.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't bad. I could dig that.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing that was really funny was, so I remembered that the guy who was the Shermanator from American Pie was in this movie, but I didn't actually remember the context, which is like, he literally doesn't have a line, and he actually has a pretty funny running joke where he's just stealing.
Right.
He's stealing things constantly. That's it. Like, and at first you see him like shoplift at the convenience store, and then you see him at the party, you know, take like a frame photo and put it away or whatever, or some heirloom. And the thing about the movie is it keeps escalating into more and more ridiculousness. At one point he just picks up a gumball machine and kind of like walks that out. Well, and then at the height of it, the cops come to like break up the party, and he literally just gets in a cop car and drives away. I just like that bit for some reason. There was no consequence and never meant anything. It was just kind of this funny runner.
Yeah, I think it was just like an airplane background side gag, which is, you know, it's nice that they, you know, bother to do that. So, you know, give him a point for that, I guess. I also, by the way, I this is sort of like the ending of an era movie, because like nowadays, this would be the most expensive movie to make ever just from the soundtrack. I mean, there was a hit song every 10 seconds.
Hey, if you missed Smash Mouth, then Fire Up Can't Hardly Wait. You will be rewarded. They had Blink 182.
Oh, my God. Yeah, they lose that point that I gave them for the background. So if they lose it for every time they put in Smash Mouth.
Oh, yeah. Which was quite
yeah,
awful.
I mean, they were like, I mean, they had the Guns N' Roses we talked about. Yep. They had 42 songs by
which
Smash
Mouth. Which I was
right,
it was Paradise City. Yes. I think I had said Sweet Child of Mine. I was incorrect. He sings Paradise City. I should definitely correct that.
But yeah, it was like listening to The Real World in the 90s. It's like there was a hit song every 5 seconds. Oh, yeah. And I'm like, nowadays, if the movie costs like $20 million, then 19.9999 would have been the soundtrack. Because it was...
Actually, the song that was the most interesting to me is, I forgot this, but the final song that happens at this train station scene, that's where Ethan Embry and Jennifer Love Hewitt hook up and, you know, kiss and stuff. In this very typical movie way of like, oh, he's leaving and it's, you know, he's going off to Boston.
He's conveniently leaving the day after, which is
like, you know, but they draw it out in the most like longest way possible where he's like, okay, I'll see you later, walks away and she looks longingly and he drops his bags and, you know, it takes forever. But the song that's playing there is called Only You, but not the like Only You. You know, it's actually this song that I know best from being constantly played in Chungking Express, the Wong Kar-wai movie. Like, it's basically like the theme song to Chungking Express.
I had forgotten that.
Yeah. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry for this interruption, but this is John Longinot, and I'm actually in the middle of editing the podcast, and I noticed a mistake that I was making while talking about the song. So the song Only You, I happen to mention, was used in a Wong Kar-wai film. However, I mistakenly started saying Chungking Express, when in fact I actually meant to say Fallen Angels. Now, forgive my confusion, but Fallen Angels is actually sort of a pseudo-sequel to Chungking Express, and in addition to that, Chungking Express has another song that's used throughout the whole movie, which is California Dreaming, which they play over and over and over again, so the motif of a song being repeated over and over, while actually in a lot of Wong Kar-wai films, is both in Chungking Express and in Fallen Angels, but the song that is used in Can't Hardly Wait, Only You, is used in Fallen Angels repeatedly over and over and over. So as you listen, as I say Chungking Express, I actually mean Fallen Angels. Please forgive me. Now, I hope you enjoy the rest of the episode, and thank you for listening. I hadn't seen Chungking Express the last time I watched this movie, but when I was watching this time, I'm like, this is just a song from the Wong Kar-wai movie. Like, you know, but it was a good song, so I was like, sure. Oh, cool, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they did not, I mean, there were very few original uses of songs in this. It really was just sort of like, hey, you've heard this song before, right? Well, we're going to plug it right into where you've heard it before.
I think that's the thing about the movie. I mean, you can say that about almost all of it. Like, there's, I'm really struggling to think of anything terribly original in the movie.
Yeah.
It's just the execution, I think, is pretty solid.
Yeah, like, I would say
definitely
that.
Above average for that kind of a movie.
For sure, for sure. And I think maybe Seth Green's character and Lauren Ambrose's character are sort of semi-unique. I mean, you've seen that type of thing before, sure. But I feel like they sort of, I don't know, they gave it the right spin.
They really play best when, you know, Seth Green has this very exaggerated caricature character, which is funny, but the scenes with him and Lauren, like, in the bathroom, they have these very naturalistic, like, he kind of breaks that character and she sort of breaks her character, and they're having these laughs and kind of moments of liking each other that honestly play pretty well. Like, I kind of believe it more than anything else in the movie.
Well, right. They're human interactions. And when they sort of, and when they interact, they sort of laugh at each other.
Yeah.
Not like, oh, because the movie demands we laugh at each other. They laugh at each other as if they're having a human conversation, which is, I feel like, all due to the two actors doing it, because it's like, if you're saying those lines and you can make them kind of, you know, have that flair, then, you know, more power to you.
I mean, there's even physical stuff where they, you know, they start basically having sex with each other, and there's bits where, you know, it would be really silly in a movie where, oh, his head hits the pipe under the faucet, and oh, they're struggling to get comfortable to have sex with each other, and you could play that full on Three Stooges,
right?
But the way they do it is, he's like, "Oh," and they're just kind of laughing it off, and it just feels like, you know, like a mumblecore movie or something. Like,
well, it's, you know, for especially for teenagers who are like desperate to have sex for the first or the second time, it's like they treat it like a grown up experience, which is like, oh wow, that's kind of mature. And so when, you know, and the kind of aftermath is kind of an interesting take on it too, because when you come back, they start to have sex and they're kind of giggling and laughing, and then they start, and then they, you know, the camera goes somewhere else to, you know, see some other bullshit, and then comes back to them and they're lying like sort of wide-eyed and you know, sort of like, oh, what did we just do? Which on the one hand, it's, you know, it's That's fine. There is something about that, though, that though it feels like the script demanded that, but those two characters didn't necessarily demand that. Their reactions immediately after were fine, but just like that moment felt like, oh, man, this is like the When Harry Met Sally moment. Let's rip that off.
Sure, sure. Well, I sort of understood it more when she kind of, the first thing she says is like, well, it gets better.
Right.
And, you know, it could even go maybe longer. And to me, the implication is just sort of like, he's a virgin. This right. is the first time it's like a horrible. Day. Like that was kind of my thing. He probably right. came in like 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Like that, well. And once you put that together, I like the way that scene plays out because he's obviously embarrassed and sort of emasculated. And so he doubles down on this homeboy, you know, persona. And it's right. just like, damn, baby, guess you didn't like the flavor or some bullshit like that. And she's just like, get the fuck out. And I actually like that they have this sort of like reconciliation scene. It's another really natural scene where, you know, he's just like, he's struggling to say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And Seth Green in like one of them, I love Seth Green, but he's like giving it everything in this scene.
100%.
Of like struggling to say, and he finally just comes out with like, I'm sorry. And then she's like, yeah, I'm sorry too. And they smile. And I was like, damn, like it was really well done.
Yeah, and I like that they're, you know, ending Chirons are, they broke up 5 minutes later.
Right.
And then got together 10 minutes later, so.
And that's the thing, they don't have a proclamation of, like, they are still together. It's not right. this, like, insane storybook, you know, and they lived happily ever after bullshit.
Yeah.
It seems so much more like a real relationship, where it's just like, yeah, she broke up with him, she wasn't so sure, and then they're, like, make up, break up, and right. maybe they'll work out, maybe they won't, like, you know, who knows.
Well, the thing is, it's like, I know in a movie like this, you need that last scene, and Union Station with the two kissing on the platform and blah blah blah, but there was something about like Lauren Ambrose and Ethan Embry had a scene together. He's about to, you know, get in his car to go to the train station, apparently just leave his car there, I guess. Yeah. That's, I don't know what's going on there, but like he's, you know, she's saying goodbye to him, and you know they've been friends, and you know she's saying, oh, I got together with the doofus, and he's like, oh, I didn't get mine, and you know maybe that's all right. And he had had an arc, he had said, oh, you know, I wanted this and it didn't happen, and, you know, I'm okay with it. Would have been nice, though. And it was just a nice, like, again, it was the most human he ever got,
sure,
honestly.
Sure.
Like, I'm sure he's, you know, fine now, but I don't understand, like, why people liked him in this movie so much, because he really is just sort of over goofy. I mean, he's really like,
yeah, I mean, that's
bug-eyed goofy
to
most
be fair
of it.
That's kind of Ethan Embry, like, I you know, yeah. Most of his parts are like that, and I think that there's this sort of charm in a sea, an ocean of a movie of womanizers, you know. I guess it's nice to have a character that is his only plot is just like, I love you for you, and I've right. just been pining for you. I mean, it is a little like stalker creepy.
Yeah, and it is a little bit of that like, but I'm a nice guy. Why can't you like me just because I'm nice? I have nothing else to add to it. I'm not interesting in any other yeah. way, but I'm nice.
Well, it's almost like it's weird. It's two characters that are solely defined by their interest in the other character. Like yeah. okay, so Jennifer Love Hewitt is sort of this shell of a character that you just project whatever you want onto, like
right.
she's, we get nothing about what was her life like, who did she know, other than she was this guy's girlfriend, right?
Right.
And then at the end of the movie, the same old thing, kisses the guy. But honestly, Ethan Embry's like, what you're talking about, he is solely defined in the film as being in love with Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Right. And
there's
having
nothing else.
Yeah, wasted 4 years of yeah. his life pining after this girl who doesn't even know he exists, quite literally. And it's like, well, that's, I mean, I guess that's romantic, but it's really kind of a waste right. of life. I mean,
but this is the thing that in high school, I found this like incredibly relatable.
Sure.
This idea of like, oh, I just want this girlfriend and I don't have anybody and I'm going to be overly romantic and
sure.
sentimental and fantasyful in my thoughts. And hope I'd get her. And now, here's a news flash for everyone in reality. That doesn't go anywhere or get
right.
you anywhere. And you definitely don't, like, write some random-ass love letter and then get the girl. That's fucking preposterous. Like, like straight up. It's just, it's insane. But that's, like, movie stuff. So it's like, okay, sure. But I can see why that, I find it really fascinating, actually, that was the story I was, like, really drawn to when I was younger. And then now I look at it and just laugh at it. I'm just like, well, that's amusing, but ridiculous. And then the like way more grounded, like messier far more realistic story of the other two people, like, is now the thing I'm fascinated with.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't surprise me that that's the story I remember, and why, like, the Jennifer Love Hewitt Ethan Embry story was practically brand new to me, because I was like, I don't remember any of this, because I was so like invested in Seth Green and Lauren Ambrose last time.
It also honestly takes up so little of the movie. Like, really, if we got the blade out and then cut this movie into like the three stories, it would maybe be like 20 minutes,
maybe
25. If you throw Jenna Fisher in the mix, you get an extra 5 minutes, but like, that's just kind of there to be there.
Like, yeah. And that's one of those like romance movie tropes where it's like, they run into the angel or they run into the thing. And it's like, I feel like maybe at the time,
sage who is the advice giver.
Yeah. I feel like if it worked at the time, then God bless. But I just look at it as like, oh yeah, it's this scene, that generic, like, meet your mentor who is also, they're an angel, but they're not really an angel because she's a stripper. You know, there's something like kind of funny about, you know, it's it's not really a God coming down to earth to tell you what's what in a Greek tragedy. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Sure.
It was not my favorite part. And there was a whole like Barry Manilow subplot that I on the one hand, I'm happy that Barry Manilow didn't like show up at the party and say, well, the thing is, Ethan Embry, what you got to do is, I mean,
be at the train station singing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess thank Christ that didn't happen, but it really did like kind of peter out the Barry Manilow story. This, because he kept like obsessing over the Barry Manilow song Mandy, like, is the song about a girl or a dog? And which is kind of funny. And then he's about to call up a radio station to get the answer, and he gets cut off by Jenna Fisher. And it's like, it's fine, and on the one hand, it's kind of cool that they just sort of like, that's the end of that story. There, right. It shall be mentioned no more. But on the other hand, actually, I made this joke to John during the movie. Jenna Fisher talks to him, and he's like trying to relate his problems, and she takes the whole thing to mean that he's in love with Barry Manilow. And she has this whole thing about like, well, I was in love with Scott Baio, and then has this whole story. And he's like, wait, no, I'm not in love with Barry Manilow. And she's like, no, it's okay, it's fine. What I thought would be really funny is if like suddenly the movie took a turn, and then he really does just fall for Barry Manilow. It would be like, talk about surprising.
Sure.
It would make up for the weird gay panic jokes that make up a good chunk of the movie.
That's a real good point. It is worth mentioning that, because this is late 90s or whatever. And you would have thought, I remember, you know, the late 90s being like, oh, we're so progressive and stuff, you know. And you watch these kind of movies now and you're just like, oh, man. Because there's a lot of, I thought you were in love with Barry Manilow. Oh, no, I'm not gay.
No, I'm not gay. That would be awful.
I'm not gay is like a little bit too much in the movie. Like there's you know, when the nerdy guy and the jock guy get pranked and put together like they're in some like BDSM bondage orgy, and the cops find them and like, oh, hey, son, you know, like there's a whole thing about that of like, oh, they look like they were fucking each other. Ha ha ha. And then the cherry on top, there is literally a moment in the most pivotal scene of the movie where Jennifer Love Hewitt is like telling off her boyfriend in this triumphant, you know, thing of just rejecting him, coming into her own identity. Everyone looks at this guy and laughs and stuff. Literally at that moment, just someone in the background just yells, fuck! And I remember going, oh, jeez.
And everybody just howls like it's the funniest thing. And you're like, oh,
and then if that wasn't like cringy enough, later, like literally two scenes later, he calls it back and he's like, and someone called me a fag. And I was just like, I mean, I know that, you know, that was a much more commonly used word back then. And it's just like, you know, maybe it was no big deal. But now I hear that, I'm just like, oh, come on.
Very Hughesian, though. That would have flown completely in a John Hughes there movie. So I guess that matches that sensibility. Yeah. So stuff like that just reminds you that, like, oh, yeah, this is also a movie of its time. I mean, as if Smash Mouth wasn't, you know, hint enough. Yep, this is a late 90s movie. And that was, I totally forgot, like, what era this came out. Even when you were talking about it, it sort of just, you know, went in one era and out the other. This movie is 20 years old now.
Yeah.
This movie is, like, it's older than its own graduation party. You know, oh, my God. Terrible. We're too old for this shit.
I'm debating what was worse, the Smash Mouth or the homophobic slur. It's a thin line.
I know. Well, all that adds up to what, John? I think now it's time to force a decision out of this.
Man, this one's hard. This one's really hard. Okay. I mean, if we're being honest, which we are, In the scale of did this movie hold up to when you first saw it, I think I am forced to render the verdict that no, it did not hold up.
Right.
In terms of I liked this movie more when I saw it in high school than when I did tonight. I think that's a fact. I found things problematic about it that I didn't then that we've discussed those. But I do want to say that, like, I don't think it's a bad movie. I think it's an entertaining, fun movie, totally worth watching. I think in this case, it just doesn't hold up to my memory of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to double down on that one. I agree. There's stuff in it that I like. There's a lot of, it's well executed, like you say. It's not like, oh, well, we can point to this. It's, you know, this is shitty and that's bad. You know, it's like, there's just choices that are made. It's like, well, you made them and now you got to live with them. It's like
right. The
Seth Green, Lauren Ambrose story. Hey, you get an A for doing that. That's great. But the rest of it is a solid C plus.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's got its...
I knock it into like B territory, you know, with the content of the story, but just with the execution.
Yeah,
like,
some of the jokes I could get that some B minus stuff. But for me, like I nailed it on the head for once. I felt exactly how I thought I would feel. I liked it. I enjoyed watching it. I did not enjoy it as much as the last time I saw it, mostly because I had higher expectations going in. I was like, oh, well, you can't pull the wool over my eyes twice. I know you have some smarts behind you. So now I'm expecting more. And so, like you say, it's not a bad movie. If I had seen it in a vacuum, then I'd probably say, oh, that's a good movie. But on second viewing, it does not hold up to the first. So here we go.
Yeah.
It does not hold up, folks. That's depressing because
no,
I feel like...
It doesn't have to be. So here's the thing. Even though the technical verdict does not hold up, like, it was still entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't fall asleep while we were watching it. Big points for that.
Yeah, we were watching comedies the last couple months couldn't make that brag.
And it's not bad. Like, it's not a bad movie. It's a perfectly fine, good movie. And the other thing is, if you have nostalgic feelings for it, like you were sort of lukewarm when you first saw it. I really loved this movie when I first saw it. And seeing it now... Nothing about the faults I've seen in it makes me, you know, like, oh, now I hate the movie, or oh, what a huge disappointment from my memory. It's just that, you know, some things lose their luster a little bit, but that doesn't mean they're terrible.
No, and I could definitely see, I mean, I could definitely picture that if I had grown up in the 90s and if I was the age of this movie, then I would also feel that nostalgia because it hits all the buttons and it does it really well. It's like, oh, you remember this moment of your life and it was defined by this song at this point, you know, so, and you were wearing these clothes. So I totally get that. I get the nostalgia factor. So since I don't have it, then I don't have to worry about it, but I can agree with that. If this was your movie in the 90s, then Mazel Tov. Enjoy. It's still good. So there.
Yeah.
All right.
But, you know, all logic and every progressive bone in my body feels like I need to recognize that the main story is pretty fucking stupid.
Well,
let's be honest.
Like, can't win them all. All right. Well, John, you want to know what we're doing next month? I don't think I've even told you what I'm planning on doing next month.
No, it's a mystery. I can't hardly wait to hear it.
I think we need to get away from comedies and go into some hard sci-fi.
Ooh, okay.
I think we need to watch Gattaca.
Oh, wow. Okay. Sure.
Nice.
I remember that.
Yeah, some Ethan Hawke. Get your sci-fi on. All right. So come back in August, folks. We'll present you with some dead serious dystopian looks at the future and see if that shit holds up.
Well, it's not like we're currently living in a dystopia or anything. So
I know
sure
it'll probably seem
fun.
All happy and shit. But, you know, this sterile environment is probably, yeah, that'd be nice.
Honestly, if DNA is the biggest issue, you know, it sounds, whisk me away. Take me to Gattaca now.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for listening, folks. As usual, if you want to get in touch with us, you can hit us at holduppodcast.com. If you want to send us an email and tell us that we're fools for giving a double thumbs down to the Can't Hardly Wait, then you can reach us at holduppodcast@gmail.com. And as always, thank you for listening, folks. Until next time.
Nobody move. Nobody gets hurt.